podcast this week, we welcome back to the podcast after many, many years away. Our son, our beautiful son, Luke Evans is back, the star of Our Son. And the wonderful Cynthia Erivo drifts in for a chat about her new film, Drift. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that can't wait to tear into the Easter eggs that my colleagues of such lethal cunning have brought for me.
It's over there.
It's over there?
Yeah.
Chris, I thought we'd all exchange at exactly the same moment, so I'm just waiting for you to produce ours so we can hand over exactly at the same time.
Oh, I see. You want a mutual handing, but that's not going to happen. Helen O'Hara, our geek queen. Hello,
hello.
Pod.
Hello.
I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Opera Podcast. Helen O'Hara, geek queen, is here. James Dyer, great big fucking nerd, is here. We're
hello.
Recording this on Wednesday, Jimbo.
We are.
Because we are going tomorrow to Salford/Manchester for the final date of our, says here, wildly successful March tour in partnership with M&M's, of course. Very, very excited about that. And I hope that it hasn't gone horribly wrong.
Yes.
By the time you listen to
this. I'm sure it will have gone swimmingly.
I'm sure it will have gone swimmingly, and I will not be doing anything to antagonise the army of Manchester United and Manchester City fans. Oh, actually, no, they're all from Manchester, so there will be Man City fans. There won't be a single Man United fan in the audience. The joke here, James, is that no Manchester United fan is actually from Manchester, that they're all from
elsewhere.
That is hilarious.
I can see that you're enjoying that joke. Mm. Would you like another?
Sure.
Okay.
Wow, Captain Holt got it from somewhere, didn't he?
Anyway, I'm very, very excited about Easter. I'm excited about the last show of the tour. There's no point asking people to come to it because this
it'll
is
already,
out already.
Have happened. Yeah.
It will already have happened.
And it will already have been a smash hit success.
A smash hit. And I hope that the audience will have all brought me Easter eggs.
I'm sure they will have.
Anywho, we have some questions.
Okay.
We have some questions for you guys. John Thorpe, 7. Over the Easter bank holiday, you tend to get more movies on TV that are Christianity themed.
Hmm.
I wonder why that is.
Doesn't shock me.
I wonder why that is. With that in mind, what is your Mount Rushmore of movies with a religious theme? See, he's lured me in. He knows I'm a sucker for Mount Rushmore questions. I fucking love a Mount Rushmore question.
God, you really do as well.
The Mount Rushmore of movies with a religious theme. Are you watching, is Bill Maher's documentary Religious on there, Helen? Or are you going full Catholic?
Full Catholic. What would that look
full
like?
Full steam ahead.
Silence.
Silence.
Martin Scorsese's Silence.
Dogma.
No, that is not one of ours.
If we're talking films that are based around religion, I would have to say Denis Villeneuve's Dune would be my pick.
No, but please surprise us, James.
Yes.
What's the religion in Dune?
Well, in many ways, the religion seeded by the Bene Gesserit around the galaxy. And of course, then the more indigenous religion of the Fremen, which Paul Atreides is the Mahdi.
I set this up.
It is your fault.
I was asking for it.
Yeah,
you were.
But yes, but please, James, do explain further at greater length while I try desperately to think of some religious-themed movies.
Yes.
Yeah. Who's your favourite?
Nuns on the Run. That is my favourite religious movie. Spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch.
Yeah, it taught me everything I know about Catholicism.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That you have to point at your spectacles, you have to point at your testicles, you have to point at your wallet, you have to point at your watch, and then Jesus says, you're in.
Thumbs up.
That's it. Two thumbs up.
Buddy Jesus.
Buddy Christ.
Yeah. Sister Inviolata of the Five Wounds.
Yes, indeed.
Are we sure?
Yes, indeed.
Mm. It's obviously actually Sister Act, though, if we're talking nun movies. I've talked about this before, but that is the film that if it is on TV, I cannot turn away. I must watch it until the end.
You love it. You love it. And where it goes, you'll follow.
Is that a song from Sister Act?
Yes.
It is. I think one of Harvey Keitel's best films.
Sister Mary Clarence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's do one. Let's do a team Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
Because if we take too long, if we all do individual Mount Rushmores, we're going to be here all year. All right?
Yeah.
So, James, are you submitting for this team Mount Rushmore?
Yes.
Which is one pick each and then one we all have to agree on.
Right.
Okay? You were submitting Nuns on the Run.
I'm sticking with Nuns on the Run, yes.
That is your religious-themed movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of all the films.
It is the best one, yes, unarguably.
That have been made by some of the greatest filmmakers. Focusing on questions of faith and spirituality and religion and God
it tackles
and our place
all of them.
In the universe.
Does it love?
Nuns on the Run is your choice.
I just want to make sure. I feel that when Robbie Coltrane span a basketball on his finger, I had a religious experience, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, even if you're narrowing it down to films featuring spectacles, testicles, wallet, and watch, surely you go for Keeping the Faith. Like, I don't even know. I mean,
James, just let me put this in a little bit of further context for you.
Sure.
Of all the films made by some of the greatest filmmakers of our time.
Yeah.
Or any time.
Starring and written by Eric Idle, that tackle notions of faith and spirituality and religion and God and our place in the universe.
I see what you're saying.
Nuns on the fucking Run is what you're going for.
Jonathan Lynn is the man.
Monty Python's Life of Brian.
No.
Did Eric Idle write Nuns on the Run? Am I getting that completely wrong? I thought he wrote it.
No, it was in fact written by Jonathan Lynn as well.
Was it written by Jonathan Lynn?
Yeah.
Well, there
written
you go.
And directed by the genius Jonathan Lynn, the seer.
The seer. He is the
Chrysanthemum. He is the Nissan Al-Ghaib, yes.
Oh, boy.
All right, okay. So you're taking Nuns on the Run above Monty Python's Life of Brian.
I am.
I just want to be absolutely clear that's what you're doing.
Yes.
All right.
Life of Brian, though, should be on this mountain.
Presumably nailed to it. Helen, what is your choice?
Well, I wasn't kidding about Silence.
I'm sure you weren't kidding about Silence.
Yeah, because nobody kids about Silence. It's not a funny movie.
If you've seen Silence, you do not kid about Silence.
And yes, in
what about Kundun?
No.
I prefer Kundun of the two. I'm a fan of Kundun.
And also, I'm sorry, but like in terms of, I just feel like if we're narrowing it down to Scorsese movies, then he's, you know, the great Catholic filmmaker. There is a case for The Wolf of Wall Street. I've made it in the past. I'm not going to repeat it here and get shouted down, but I genuinely think it's actually a very moral movie. And
it's not a religious movie.
No, I know, but it's a moral movie.
But the God in that is a very different type of God, Helen.
Manon.
Am I right?
Yes.
Yes.
Anyway, so I don't love The Last Temptation of Christ as a movie.
Wow, I'm going to tell Jesus on you.
Yeah, that's
What
fine.
About The Passion of the Christ?
I think that we're going to leave that one aside, aren't we? Of
Pop Goes Cafeezel.
Hey. No? It's. I think it's, you know, strikingly short. I'm going to leave it at that one. I'm not getting into film at all.
So your choice on
I'm
your
going for
slot.
Silence, yeah. I didn't like Mary Magdalene. I'm still trying to keep it biblical.
All right.
I really didn't like Exodus, Gordon Kings. Whoosh.
What about the Ten Commandments?
Noah was kind of fun.
Do you like a bit of a Chuck Heston, Moses?
It's a bit much. And his hair just looks dyed, I'm sure.
Fucking you do not come
Ben
with
Hur, maybe?
Heston.
Do we Ben Hur?
Ben Hur? Is it that? Listen, it's your choice. But you've gone for Silence, but you can retract that choice.
No, I'm sticking with Silence. I feel good about
it's
that.
It's no Nuns on the Run.
No, that's correct. Yeah. That is correct.
Who can forget the famous scene where Big Liam goes, spectacles, testicles, wallet, and a watch. I'm going to go for... All right, I'm not a religious person.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, I am.
Well, I just assume that you're a lapsed Catholic.
Mm.
And at some point that lapse will run out.
Like a parking meter.
I don't think that's how it works.
That's exactly how it is.
Okay.
Whereas I'm a lapsed Protestant. Which means I didn't really give a shit in the first place. I give less of a shit. But I will say that I'm going to go for a... This won't surprise anybody who listens to this podcast regularly. It's obviously Evil Dead 2. No. I'm going to go for The Omen. The Omen my choice. I'm going to go for religious horror in the different vein. I think Immaculate was a very, very good entry in this category. I think I'm bound by an embargo on what I think of the first Omen, which is out next week. Come back for my
No, you can talk about the first Omen, you just can't talk about the most recent one.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I love The Omen. I love the first Omen. The first Omen is tremendous. Dick Donner, Gregory Peck.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. The greatest decapitation in the history of movies. It's just, what a film. What a score. Jerry Goldsmith, Dominoes.
But is there a bit where the priest goes into the girl's showers while pretending to be a nun?
Oh, Jesus.
Because I'm saying...
Drop it.
Yeah.
That is a seminal scene.
It is.
Ew.
Helen!
Seminarian scene.
I did not have any innuendo in my head when I said that word.
You are a liar.
How
you
dare
always you? Have innuendo in your head and you know it.
It's true. It's true. I do. The Omen is fantastic. And who could forget the scene where Patrick Troughton
The Doctor Who, who was very, very high on our list of movie Doctor Who's the other week, which list had caused some controversy, by the way, which yes, we haven't revisited, because I forgot to actually look at William Hartnell's CV, and he'd been in loads of great stuff. Mm. So
also, we didn't include the Fugitive Doctor, but that's neither here nor there.
I'm not including the Fugitive Doctor. No, come on. That wasn't something you discussed, and we're not counting Peter Cushing, who made two Doctor Who films. We're not counting him. No. Come on.
Wow.
Sort it out. Jesus Christ. And now we're back on topic.
Hey. There we go.
And yeah, The Omen is tremendous. And Patrick Troughton as Father Brennan, the bit where he goes to Gregory Peck, he goes, "When the Jews return to Sion and a comet rips the sky, when the Roman Empire rises, then you and I must die. From the eternal sea he rises, creating armies on either shore, pitting man against his brother, till spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch." It's chilling.
So memorable.
It's really chilling. Mm. Yeah. Dominoes.
Sure.
Great film. All right. That's on the list. That's on Mount Rushmore. Now we have to agree on the fourth choice.
Well, by vetoing James, we all agree that it's Life of Brian.
We're going to have a vote in this. I'm voting Life of Brian.
I'm voting Life of Brian.
Nuns on the Run.
You've already got Nuns on the Run.
I know, but I'm voting. Oh, okay. So can I have it twice? Can I have Eric Idle's face and Robbie Coltrane's face, like both of them together?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Robbie Coltrane. Who would you have? Who's your face from Silence? Is it Marty or is it Adam Driver, Andrew Garfield, or Big Liam? And is it just Big Liam's face? Come on now. And
it's Garfield.
Mm. The cat or the movie star?
The cat. No, the movie star, but with the hair. The hair was magnificent in that film.
The hair is always magnificent.
I know, but particularly so there.
Good hair on Andrew Garfield. And then my choice, it's got to be David Warner's severed head flying through the air.
Oh, so this is going to rotate on the mountain.
It's going to rotate. It's a revolving Mount Rushmore.
I mean, it might confuse people. People might think it's The Exorcist and not The Omen. That's the only worry.
No, because it's a different rotation. But
okay.
Reagan's head in The Exorcist revolves on a 360-degree horizontal pivot,
mm-hmm.
right?
And this would be a...
Yes, Jennings' head in The Omen.
More of a tumble.
It's a tumble. It's a forward roll of a head.
Okay.
And it's flying through the air, whereas hers was tethered.
Yeah.
All right, I'm very happy with this lineup.
I'm not happy that we've got Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle counting as two entries.
I'm pretty pleased.
When The Life of Brian isn't on there.
This is how you could do it. You could have Eric Idle on there.
That was his argument that we should, instead of putting The Life of Brian on, we should put both of his heads on separately.
You could just have Eric Idle's head and it can multitask. So it can be from Life of Brian, but it can also be from Nuns on Their Own.
No, Eric Idle's...
You just won't have the wimple.
It wouldn't be Brian, would he?
Eric Idle's head has to be... It has to be Life of Brian. Life of Brian is represented by Eric Idle. Ideally, he's one of the people on the crosses at the end, on the crucifixes. He sings, "Always look on the bright side of life."
Wearing a wimple.
Cheer up, Brian. Some things in life, I said, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. So that's on there. And then we have Robbie Coltrane. Then we have Andrew Garfield. And then finally, David Warner's forever
and
severed.
So, and if his head is spinning, does that mean that Robbie Coltrane's basketball can also be spinning? Like, he can have that on his, and that will be spinning as well. Okay.
Eric Idle is spectacles.
Well, now I feel
Robbie Coltrane is testicles.
Yes.
Andrew Garfield is wallet. And David Warner's forever spinning severed head is watch.
Wow.
Thank you. Plant_sauce, thoughts on the use of generative AI in Late Night with the Devil and the subsequent backlash. This is something I was unaware of last week when we were reviewing Late Night with the Devil, that they, the filmmakers, the Cairns brothers, used some AI to help generate some of their interstitial artwork that is on display during the film. And there was outrage and an outcry about this, and even a call for a boycott of the movie, which I have to say seemed a little unfair because it was an indie movie that needs all the bums on seats it could get. Do you see that outrageous claim that it made $666,666 at the US box office on Sunday?
Yeah. Which was not quite true. But
if you're
ever going to round it up or down, I can't remember which, I think up slightly, that's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it, you know? Yeah. So. It just pipped Chinny Reckon, the Dickie Davis story, to the top spot. But what do you think about this? Because, you know, we've talked about AI in the past and how I feel that it shouldn't be used in movie making, especially if it's going to take away jobs from humans. A human could have designed those things.
Yeah.
But I feel like a boycott of a small indie is perhaps going a bit too far.
I think that's too far, but I do think it's not a bad thing for to be reported and for people to express their opinions about, because it does take away money from actual artists. These, I mean, it was basically, what, two or three interstitials from when the show within the movie cuts to commercial and that were apparently AI generated. And that wouldn't have broken the budget, I don't think, to do it with a person do it.
I agree.
I don't think it would have taken a massive amount of extra time, even if it was quite late in the day that they decided to do it.
I agree.
So I just think it's unfortunate that they went this route, really.
Yep.
And I would like to not do that.
You can see how, Jimbo, you can see how people, filmmakers, might be seduced by this. It's something that can be done fairly easily and might...
I'm quite pessimistic about all this stuff. Like, I do feel like we are sort of like screaming into the void and pissing into the wind and many other metaphors that end unpleasantly. I do feel like this is just going to happen across all sorts of industries. Like, you've already seen the amount of websites out there that are using AI-generated editorial.
I'm not real.
You know, absolutely. We
Chris
have an
AI, AI for you.
We have an AI Chris here, artificial anyway. And, you know,
it's the term artificial person myself.
That's right, yes. The Sophons of our running Pilot TV podcast. Look, it's. I think it's inevitable that people are going to use these tools, and you know, in some areas, I have no objection to it. So people, we all three of us use AI to transcribe our interviews. That
no,
is
I don't. I do it myself.
No,
I
you
do
don't.
It myself.
No,
it takes
you don't.
Me ages.
You know, and that's a valuable tool, and that saves us time. That's fine. But I think when you are using AI for creative endeavors, then the problem with it is because of the nature of the way AI works. Like, right, so it's not like AI is pulling this shit out of its digital ass. It is scraping the internet for stuff, and it is plagiarizing. But it's not, I mean, plagiarism is still plagiarism, whether you're plagiarizing one thing or you're plagiarizing 1,000 things. You are still taking someone else's content and repurposing it and passing it off as your own, which is kind of what AI does, right? Like, it finds this text out there and it repurposes it. So it's not composing this stuff. So ethically, it's a little riffing on it. Yeah, it's a little bit dodgy.
It's a lot dodgy.
Yeah.
I know what you're right about. I know what you mean about, you know, we can't necessarily fight the tide on this. And, you know, that seems to be the way things are going, because everybody in charge, everybody with money, is desperate to cut costs wherever they can and to hell with people wherever they can. And that's why we're in this situation. But this is what we've been talking about a lot, which is the danger of losing creativity and the danger of devaluing creativity and the danger of feeling like you can remove the human element, the inefficient, messy, ask for a pay rise human element and you know, replace it with something more streamlined. Like, I don't think ultimately you get good art that way. I think you can get away with it for a while, but I don't think ultimately you can get anything really, truly fresh or new. And look, who cares about fresh or new in an interstitial, in a TV show, in a movie? Like, it's not the most egregious use of it. The most egregious use actually is probably in making decisions about what gets made and trying to make things that are actively like everything we've seen before. That's what's a far worse use, and that's much more invisible.
And
that kind of thing, exactly.
Like,
yeah. And that's far, far harder to spot, at least at our end of the sort of production pipeline.
And the early models had rubber skin, which made them harder to spot.
but that's, you know, and that worries me maybe more than this kind of stuff. But this kind of stuff is also not great, because that is an artist who could have had, I don't know, a couple of thousand quid at most.
Yep.
I mean, I think much less than that probably, and had their work featured in what has become a hit picture. You know,
very good film.
It's a very good film, otherwise. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we had a couple of tiny issues with some of the camera work, but otherwise, we're into it. And so I think it's a real shame that they would deprive somebody of that opportunity.
I very much agree.
Look at Secret Invasion. Like, the AI title sequence for that was an abomination. Not the worst thing about Secret Invasion, as it turned out, but, you know, that was, it felt like that was a sign of, you know, things to come.
But the backlash against that, and I think Late Night with the Devil, that might make filmmakers and studios think a little bit twice.
In the short term, I think.
So. Yeah.
I think in the long term, unfortunately, profitability will undoubtedly win out.
But also profitability, again, like, long term, there is more risk in losing creativity. That is a bigger risk long term than
You tell it to Wall Street, Helen.
I know.
Tell it to Wall Street.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, that's anyway. Fun. That was a fun detour. Thanks, guys. Yeah. Well, by the way, James, I transcribe everything myself. I don't use otter.ai. I only just realized recently that it is AI. And I was like, oh, what's the AI stand for?
Well, Chris.
AI. But, you know, it has it transformed
but
my life.
That's what it's meant to be used for. It's meant to be used for taking some of the grind out of what is otherwise a creative endeavor. You do the interview, which involves two humans interacting, one would hope. And then you have some machine help you with the boring transcription bit, and then you, a human, honestly, I'm pretty sure.
And that is something that I would do myself.
I want to read an interview, but it was only available as a video. So I dragged the file and slung it to Mac Whisper, which is my AI transcription tool of choice, and then just read the transcript. And I was like, that was awesome. I loved it. So that's quite handy.
The pivot to video has been very bad for fast readers.
I'm not a fast reader, but I still would much rather absorb information by reading it than by watching an incredibly
slow video. Also, if you're looking for a specific thing, you can control F,
right?
Find the specific thing, not read the whole thing. Anyway.
It's true, because I'm like you, I'm a fast typist, and I used to transcribe my stuff myself, but it would still take ages. And if you did 12, 13 interviews for a cover feature, and you had, imagine if I had to transcribe the Macquarie interviews for Dead Reckoning Part 1. Because the rule of thumb used to be, it would be twice the length of time that the interview took place. That's 32 hours of my life that I have saved because of Otter. And yes, does it make me a hypocrite? Is that hypocritical? Yes, it is.
That's what AI is supposed to be doing. AI is supposed to be helping creative people be creative, not helping uncreative people fake it.
True. But Helen, as I often say, you can't spell hypocritical without AI.
Wow.
Right. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire podcast, you can get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. Yes, Twitter. And you can slide into my DMs. You can reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course. Or you can reply to a panicked shout out of a Thursday or Wednesday afternoon in this case. All right. Guest time. We have two cracking British actors. We have Cynthia Erivo and Luke Evans this week. Hell's bells. Who do you want?
Oh, Cynthia Erivo. I think she's great.
Cynthia Erivo. You think she's great. And by definition...
No, that's not what I meant.
And by process of deduction, you mean that Luke Evans is not great?
No, I think he's also great, but I think she's... I've met her and she was lovely.
You must have met Luke Evans. He's done the podcast.
I know, yeah, but like, I don't feel like I got talking to him.
He's in good stuff.
He's great. I love him. But like, I think she's greater. I feel like we bonded, you know? That's all I'm saying.
You feel you bonded?
Yeah.
Okay, Cynthia Erivo. So she is a British actress. She is a Broadway star. She is a sensational singer, performer, actor. Burst onto the scene with Bad Times at the El Royale. Got Oscar nominated for Harriet a couple of years ago. And she's sensational this week in Drift, in which she plays a Liberian refugee who is scrambling to survive in Greece as a refugee. And she strikes up a tentative friendship with a tour guide played by Alia Shawkat. This is a terrific film and a terrific performance in it. And I spoke to her about this movie on Zoom a couple of weeks ago. Now, I will say that this kind of deviates somewhat from our usual Empire podcast interview style, which sometimes can go all over the place and delve into a person's career and you basically talk about whatever we want to talk about. In this case, I was fascinated by it. There's a scene towards the end of the movie, which is one of the greatest performances you will see in many a moon. And I wanted to talk to her about that. And turns out she wanted to talk about that as well. So pretty much the entire 15 minutes of this interview is talking about that one scene, how she approached it, how she navigated it, how she felt afterwards, the psychological impact of it on her. And I really, really loved talking to Cynthia Erivo about this. And so perhaps only listen to this after you've seen Drift and then you can fully understand the lengths that she went to in this scene. But here she is talking about it in depth for nearly 15 minutes. The great Cynthia Erivo. Do please enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the star and producer of Drift, Cynthia Erivo. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. I am in a chair that is much less resplendent than the one you're sitting in right now.
Another word, resplendent. I haven't heard that word used for a while and we must use it more.
Got to dust off our favourite words and use them a bit more often. Yeah.
For the folks at home who can't see, it is, it's just like, it's a massive, great, big green armchair. But there's, is that a throw behind you, or is that?
It's like a weighted green velvet throw over the, I just like dressed it a little bit.
I am I'm sitting in an office chair I nicked from work during the pandemic and haven't given back.
There is no shame in that game either. If it's a good, if it has a good, comfortable back, you're good.
Absolutely, absolutely. Simon Pegg, I don't know if you know this, but Simon Pegg has a chair that he loves, that he sits in, he brings to all his productions, and it's like his, he calls it Jeff after Jeff Bridges, but he sits in it and it really helps him get through difficult shoots. Now, Drift, for all kinds of reasons, I'm guessing was a difficult shoot. Was a comfortable chair part of the way that helped you get through it?
No, a good therapist was the way I got through it, to be honest. I wish a good chair was the way to get through it, but that gave me respite for 2 seconds, but I was on my feet for most of it. I had a really good team around me. My producing partner, Salome Williams, was a force, and the other production companies, who Memento Films, and they were all really, really wonderful. But Salome was like my right hand in this, and she was incredible. And I had an amazing therapist who really was on call, and I could, you know, check in with if I was feeling a little bit loopy and needed some help to just like recenter.
Yeah. That's fascinating, because so this was someone that you were calling during the shoot, during, after difficult scenes, before difficult scenes?
So I wish I had the foresight to have done that, but I think it was mostly after difficult scenes, but because a lot of the scenes were difficult, technically I was speaking to them after and before something was we had a difficult scene. So yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, so obviously I've spoken to a lot of actors over the years, and you know, many of them have had difficult experiences on set. And I wonder how this such maybe a strange thing that's popped into my head, but I wonder how much actors look after their mental health during filming.
I have learned to be really good about it. I was not good about it at the very beginning of my career because I don't think I had the wherewithal to realize it. I'm not entirely sure that a lot of us are very good at it. But I think for me, it's like, one of the things that's at the top of the list so that I can actually move through the process with grace and come out on the other side feeling whole. Even when a process is really enjoyable, you're still working, you know, towards the end of something. So even if I've done a project and it feels really great, I know that I want to make sure that I'm speaking to someone so that I can wean myself off the project to come away and not feel like I've left people behind, because you end up creating a family that you ultimately have to say goodbye to at the end of every single project. So you're saying goodbye every time you finish, which I don't think a lot of us realize. And sometimes you want to say goodbye. Other times you really don't want to say goodbye at all. But in a project like this, there was just no way I was not going to do this with help. I knew I couldn't do it without someone holding my hand through it and just talking me through whenever I had to go through some difficult things. Yeah.
You play Jacqueline, who is a woman who finds herself on this Greek island and has gone through the most traumatic experience I think is possible for anyone to go through. And as producer as well, you must go into this knowing at a certain point that there's an astonishing scene towards the end, which I imagine was incredibly difficult. And as producer, you must have known that was coming up. And so that is something that you're protecting yourself, surrounding yourself in order to give Cynthia, the actor, the best chance of nailing it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You have to work with, I had to work with my team to make sure that, and when I say my team, I mean the film team on the ground,
yeah,
to make sure that everything was set up in a way so that I wouldn't get distracted, because I really wanted to dive into it as much as I possibly could. I wanted to really be in the center of that moment, because the moment doesn't work unless I'm all the way in. And that is really tough, because you're also wanting to make sure that there's enough privacy, and you want to make sure that the lighting is the right, the lighting has enough time to do it for themselves. And, you know, obviously everyone's rushing around and they have to talk, and you want quiet so that you can actually concentrate. And those moments are really tough. So you are wearing producer hat and actor hat at the same time. But if you're lucky, you can have a really great producing partner, which I did. Her name is Salome Williams. And she made sure that the space was protected for me. We really, like, anyone who wasn't meant to be on the set wasn't on the set. It was a closed set for me to be able to do that moment. The few people that were needed to be in the room were in the room, but we also were very aware of what the circumstances were. So everyone was very respectful, very quiet. The tough thing about those moments is that you're not just filming it once, you're doing it more than once. I think we did that about 4 or 5 times. And so you really do have to, there is a point where I have to lock everything out to stay in it so that I can keep going with it, which can be really painful. And I know I'm sure I was unbearable that day. I think I probably was, just because you have fear, you have pain, you are dealing with feeling very, very vulnerable, very, very, I mean, in this case, both physically and mentally naked in front of people. And you're sort of having to dig out the darkest and the hardest parts of yourself in front of people on a camera. And so you just try to set yourself up so you can do that without feeling super self-conscious, because you have to let go in order to do something like that.
Yeah. I mean, and then part of you must also be thinking, this is going to be one of the signature scenes of this film. It's going to be one of the standout moments of this film. So whenever the film comes out, I'm going to be talking about it again. I'm going to be on the Empire podcast, and I'm going to be asked about it, and I'm going to relive that moment as well.
Yeah. And it's really strange, because, like, it's always really that part is, and I thought I would be able to do this without getting to this point. I've been able to talk about this scene usually without getting emotional for a while, but at the very beginning, I couldn't really talk about it without feeling all of the feelings come up again. But that scene was just really tough, and you don't realize that in those images don't ever go away. So I can remember everything like it was yesterday. I can remember what the bath looked like. I can remember what the walls looked like. I can remember what was in front of me. I remember where my DOP was sitting to film it. I remember who was in the room. I remember the room behind it. Like, I remember all of it. It's as vivid a picture as you can paint. And even like talking about that puts a lump in my throat, just because I can remember, when you remember all of that, you remember how it feels. Be there. Yeah. But I think it's kind of wonderful to be able to go back to something that vivid, because it hopefully means that I was being truthful and telling the truth, and hopefully someone else watches that experience and is compelled to share their own. Yeah.
I believe me, I really don't want to make you rake over the coals of that scene anymore. But
I'm really proud of that scene, though.
Absolutely.
I will say, I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of it, because that's not what the scene was when I first got the script. That script was a lot less. There were a lot less words in it. It was far fewer words in that, and I sort of fought to give that scene more, because I think that we had lived with her keeping everything to herself for such a long time that I felt like it was really apt that at this point, when she sat in water and she's open and bare, that she actually bears her soul, that she actually bears what's left of her. And so that the fact that we managed to get to that point and that we were able to do that just makes me really, really happy. I'm really proud of it. Yeah.
Yes, it's interesting. Like, there's the title of the film is Drift, and you get a sense that, understandably so, given everything she's been through, she is drifting. She's still in a state of shock, I think. Yeah. And there's almost a sense that she doesn't want to interact with water, other people, elements, all of it, until this moment.
That's exactly it. I think all of it reminds her. It's like if you imagine her as like a walking wound. When a wound is raw, you don't want to touch it. You don't want anything to go onto it. You definitely don't want warm or hot water on it. You certainly don't want salt water on it, because it will hurt more. And I think that is what's happening. She doesn't want any human touch, because that means that she has to connect with a person, and she's already lost so many people already. And the possibility of connecting with a person means that the possibility of losing a person is opened again. And if you're just alone, you're alone. She doesn't, touching, being with elements means that it's sort of, I think, a reminder of home, a reminder of who she used to be. And water does something to everyone. Water either makes you full of fear or completely relaxed. And if you're completely relaxed, well, what do? You share. Everything comes out. Everything, you can't help but to be open. And I think she's petrified of that, because if she has to explain it, if she has to say what's happened, then she has to admit that it happened. When floating around in a state of shock, there's still a possibility, because I haven't said anything out loud and I haven't spoken to anyone, that it might have been a dream, that it might not have been real. But if you have to admit that it was real, then it was real.
Just very quickly, because I've got to let you go. When you were shooting that scene, and I'm so sorry that this has turned into a 15-minute discussion of...
I'm really grateful to talk about it. Thank you.
No, I'm blown away by the movie, and blown away by that scene in particular, and I can't shake it. So I'm grateful for this chance to have some therapy as well. Had you shot the flashback stuff? So did you have a sense memory of what you were, of what Jacqueline was experiencing?
Yeah. We shot all of that at the top of the movie. Then we had shot the whole thing. And that bath scene was almost one of the last scenes that we shot. Yeah, I think it was the last scene we shot. It may have been the last thing.
Wow. I mean, it's extraordinary. It is extraordinary. And Cynthia, I'll say this, that chair, it looks very, very comfortable indeed. And I hope it is, because I've just taken you through 15 minutes of therapy.
No, you're very welcome, and I'm glad to have spoken to you. Thank you so much for this. This is really lovely. I loved talking about this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much indeed, and best of luck with everything. Cynthia Erivo, thank you.
Okay, that was Cynthia Erivo. We'll be talking about Drift later on in the reviews section of the show. But first, it is time to dig deep into the movie news section. Is there any? First of all, has there been any movie news? Has anything happened?
Well, while we were on stage in our show in Dublin, they announced that the Beetlejuice trailer
had
dropped.
Show in Dublin.
The Triumphant Show.
Triumphant Show.
So the new Beetlejuice film has a trailer. Have you seen it?
The new what?
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
No!
Beetlejuice.
And this is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. So they're stopping just short of saying it. And this is the reunion of Tim Burton and Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder and Catherine O'Hara, no relation.
Yes.
And the addition of Jenna Ortega into the mix.
Yeah.
And it looks good. It's kind of taking the piss a little bit out of those very ominous, slowed down choral versions of popular songs.
Well, yes, they are indeed.
Very popular in trailers these days.
It's a good musical notes. And obviously we would have done a drop in and recorded this the day after the live podcast. But by then the news would have been a day old.
Oh boy.
Because that is a song with Lampooning, which of course was in the first one. What did you think of this? We only get a little glimpse of Michael Keaton.
I don't know much to say, is it? It's hard to kind of, it's like, oh yeah, I recognise you. Oh yeah, I recognise you. Oh, it's Michael Keaton.
We wouldn't do a Treader breakdown for this one.
No, there's not much to break down, but it certainly has the atmosphere, it has the mood, it has the little model village. It's got everything that you kind of want.
Yeah.
So it certainly makes me want to see the film.
I enjoy that Winona Ryder's character has not changed her hairstyle in 30 years. That's always fun.
Aggressively spiky fringe.
Yes. But yeah, really fun. Here for it.
Right. So it seems to be, if I'm guessing, just from the trailer, that someone has died in the Dietz. Was it the Dietz family? Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no Gina Davis or Alec Baldwin this time around. Presumably they've moved on. They've gone to the other side and they're all happy. And Lydia's daughter, played by Jenna Ortega, is somehow tricked into bringing Beetlejuice back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe her dad has died, do you think?
Possibly, yeah.
Explain why she's a bit sad.
Yeah. Was Catherine O'Hara her mum?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, that explains
Winona's
mum, yeah. Winona's mum, yeah. I haven't seen the original in a long, long time, so I need to go and revisit that. That's exciting. Good stuff. Well done, them. Bad Boys for Life 2, the trailer.
Ride or Die.
Sorry.
Die.
No one refers to this franchise as Bad Boys for Life. Yes, Bad Boys, Ride or Die, the trailer for Bad Boys 4, was unleashed, much to my delight, because I adored Bad Boys for Life.
I detested Bad Boys for Life. So we are not aligned.
I thought it was fine.
Yay!
We span the entire spectrum here.
We have covered all bases.
Yeah.
So this is Will Smith and Martin Lawrence back as character names?
Mike Lowrey. And Marcus Burnett.
Yeah. Fucking hell, that's good. That's good.
Big fan of the original Bad Boys. Love it. Tolerated the second one, but Bad Boys for Life can jump in the sea.
Bad Boys for Life did interesting stuff, and it was funny. It introduced new characters who don't seem to have come back for this one.
No, there's a couple of them, I think.
Yeah, did we see Vanessa Hudgens?
No.
Oh.
I didn't think so, but you know, in the group. Anyway, I was struggling to remember the character who is in high security lockdown, who was very important at the end of the last
Will
film.
Will Smith's son, yes.
No, okay, well, I wasn't going to spoil it on the podcast in case anyone out there hadn't seen it.
I think the statute of limitations has been lifted on.
Yeah, I feel like you could put a gun to my head and I wouldn't know that guy's name, so.
Jacob Scipio is the character's name.
Who can forget?
And it's the actor's name. Jacob Scipio is the actor's name.
And the character.
And the character's name is Will Smith's son.
Oh, wow. It's amazing that was a twist in the film, then, isn't it?
I think we would have seen it coming.
You really would.
He has a lot to atone for, that motherfucker.
He really does.
Like, he does.
It was an odd choice to make him quite as evil as he was and then have the sort of, you know, shoehorned in redemption arc, let's be honest.
This is your favourite thing, Helen, because in this movie we see him teaming up with his dad. Yes, the cat in the bag, truly on that one, with his dad and I presume his uncle. I know that Mike and Marcus aren't related, but I'm going to say Uncle
Mike. Aren't they really?
Aren't they? They're brothers, aren't they? Really?
Really.
Linked by everything but blood.
Ride or die, you might say.
Ride or die. Not a porno.
That, what? Oh, like an Irish porno?
Like a Colin Farrell sex tape.
Gorgeous.
Don't start again, please. Anyway, yes. So this time, their former boss, Joey Pants, has been framed as a corrupt cop, and they, I guess, by implication, are also corrupt cops. So as they're trying to clear his name, their own names become besmirched.
Besmirched.
Yeah. And then they have to team up with Bad Guy to do things.
Yes, they have to team up with Bad Guy.
It looks... I mean, it doesn't look great, if I'm honest, on the basis of this trailer.
You lie.
I did enjoy how Adil and Bilal did the action last time.
Yes.
And I thought they had a good sense of that. So, you know, every day is Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm in a room with enemies. Are you sure that neither of you are AI? This feels like AI might say. Mm. No, I thought this looked like a lot of fun. But I genuinely hope, like the last one did take some interesting risks and did try, before it became nonsensical, to tackle concepts of aging and mortality and the fact that Mike Lowrey in particular feels like he is invulnerable, and then he's not invulnerable. And it was playing with interesting notions. And then there was a helicopter and things got mad.
Yeah.
But I really, the first hour and a half of that movie is really fun.
I didn't love the team, so I don't mind if they're not all back, but there were a few young people who I assumed were members of the team because I didn't remember them all.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think Charles Melton is back.
Oh, yeah.
In this one. He was in the last one, but I don't think he's back in this one because he's making proper films now, isn't he? With proper directors like Todd Haynes.
Indeed.
But nevertheless, I'm looking forward to Bad Boys, Ride or Die. Anything else?
Let that franchise die. And speaking of which, Helen.
No, I was going to say, speaking of proper directors.
Oh.
Kind of Kindness has a trailer. That is the new one from Yorgos Lanthimos.
Oh, it does, yes.
Yeah, with, Emma Stone's back in it. Willem Dafoe is back in it. Margaret Qualley's in it, Joe Alwyn, Jesse Plemons, Hong Chau, Mamadou Athi, Hunter Schafer. Really, really good cast. I'm listing them all because I've watched this trailer and I have no fucking clue what the film is or even vaguely.
Looks lovely,
I assume, given the people in who made it, it's going to be fucking weird and I'm going to be delighted by it.
Yes. In case people wonder whether this was shot really, really quickly. I believe this was shot in 2021 or 2022.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So kind of Poor Things leapfrogged it?
I think there's a chance they may have shot this before Poor Things.
Wow, okay. So the synopsis apparently is that it is a triptych fable,
ooh,
which we should have guessed, obviously.
Of course.
Like Bad Boys, Ride or Die.
Following a man without choice who tries to take control of his own life, a policeman who is alarmed that his wife, who was missing at sea, has returned and seems a different person.
Okay.
And a woman determined to find a specific someone with a special ability who is destined to become a prodigious spiritual leader.
At least it's not vague.
Well, that's all very specific.
I mean, that last one sounds like Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. The second one sounds like
Sulkies.
Bad Boys, Ride or Die.
Sulkies.
So, yeah, maybe. What if he's like stealth remaking Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice and Bad Boys, Ride or Die
before
already,
they've even come
before
out?
Before they've even come out. That's
amazing.
Now, that's a visionary genius, if you ask me.
Really astonishing.
But yeah, what were you going to say before?
I was going to say, while we are flogging franchises to death that should have been left in the ground.
The Empire Podcast.
Pirates of the Caribbean is being rebooted with a young cast, and it's made me feel very tired and very old.
I mean, they've been saying this for a while.
Yeah, but Jerry Bruckheimer's gone on the level saying, it's happening, it's definitely happening. And it's like, oh, thanks, Jerry, that's great.
He's been saying that for a while, though.
Yeah. I'm not sure what's new about this. Like, I guess.
Does it need rebooting? Is it a much loved franchise?
But isn't this just because he's promoting a movie at the moment, the new Guy Ritchie film, and people are interviewing him and they're going, so what's the deal with Top Gun 3? And he goes, well, maybe one day we'll make Top Gun 3. And then people report it as news. And then they go, what's happening with Pirates of the Caribbean, Jerry? And he goes, well, we're looking at rebooting it. And then it's not actually news.
Yeah, that's kind of how it feels to me as well.
There's little substance. Have you brought a story with substance? Have you brought a story with substance? Because this feels insubstantial. I've got a story with substance right here.
Oh, do you?
I do.
Is it about Bad Boys again? Because I don't think I could cope with that.
It is about Bad Boys.
Oh, Jesus.
Because in a way, aren't all news stories about Bad Boys?
No, they're not.
Not usually.
Actually, this is about a bad boy.
Oh,
actually.
Is it?
It's about a really bad boy.
Oh, gosh.
Mm. Perhaps one Helen might like to punish.
Steady on.
Chef, corner, hand, behind. None of these things can be used to punish this person.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It is Jeremy Allen White.
Yep.
Who, of course, is the star of our beloved The Bear.
Mm-hmm.
The Bear! And he is apparently in talks. Okay, so it's not that substantial.
Not terribly substantial.
No. And all I've read is a headline, in fairness. But he's apparently in talks. What? What do you want from me?
For Who's the Boss
Too? I know the rest of this. Kind of, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. To play Bruce Springsteen, friend of the pod, in a Bruce Springsteen bossopic.
I mean, okay, they put two pictures of them next to each other, like young Bruce and Jeremy.
I don't see it myself.
No,
That's a great Jeremy Allen White.
I honestly don't think he's as handsome as young Bruce Springsteen.
Young Bruce Springsteen.
But there is a vague air of similarity otherwise.
Yes.
Young Bruce Springsteen was a smoke show. Like, he was very, very handsome.
I mean, old Bruce Springsteen.
I mean, yes, also. Yeah, very handsome. But, so I feel like Jeremy Allen White is handsome in a different way to that. Like, maybe a less obvious, maybe less handsome way.
Right.
No disrespect. He's a very handsome man. But, like,
wow.
Bruce Springsteen was on a whole other level. So,
wow.
But at the same time, he's got acting chops and it's better to have a good actor, right? So
it's good to have acting chops.
It is.
So this is going to be called Deliver Me From Nowhere, and it is about the making of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska, which is weird because I thought that Alexander Payne made Nebraska.
Oh, boy.
Every time James Dyer yawns in the Empire podcast, an angel gets its wings. And it's going to be directed by Scott Cooper, who is a purveyor of most excellent, but sometimes somber and quite difficult sits.
Okay.
Things like the pale Blue Eye and Hostiles and Out of the Furnace and Black Mass. And films like that. And that one with Jesse Plemons and the Big Moose.
I didn't like a lot of those, but I do like Bruce Springsteen. But I don't know that this is the album I do it about. But that's okay. It's not my my problem.
It's a great album.
Like, it comes right after The River.
Well, most things do. The River is a tributary.
And before Born in the USA.
Well.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
But hey, look, it's obviously there's a story on this one that there maybe isn't for those. So great.
I'm guessing so.
Yeah. There's another musical story this week.
Oh.
Yes, which is the news that Ryan Coogler is set to produce a new Prince musical movie.
What?
Now, we
front door.
Don't know really anything about it yet.
Right.
Brian Edward Hall, who worked on the Titans DC series.
Yes.
Has written a draft of the script, but apparently more are expected. And I don't know, it's not clear to me if it's going to be a jukebox musical, so it's not going to be maybe a Prince biopic, because who do you get to play Prince? Do you know what I mean? He's a very particular kind of person and a very teeny one.
little teeny tiny Prince.
Yeah. So I don't know who could do that, but jukebox musical might work, I guess.
Yeah, possibly.
Dude got some mad tunes.
He did, also about 4,500 of them, or something like that. He was incredibly prolific.
It's amazing, and could play basically all of the instruments, sing all of the notes, like a most enormous range in pop.
Name a note. Well,
could perform
Roy
with
Orbison
his.
Might want to have a battle with him, but yes. name a note.
A G sharp above high C.
Prince could sing that.
I bet he could.
There we go.
He could perform with his bum out. He could do whatever.
He could perform with his bum.
With his bum out.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Mm. Ryan Coogler is about to embark upon a new film with Michael B. Jordan, which is an untitled event movie. Some people are saying it might be vampire related. So,
speaking of horrors.
Yes. The Empire podcast.
Maybe. Horror maestros Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill.
I do see Robert Cargill.
No, but okay, but like him.
He's over there.
Okay.
Oh, wow, I see what you mean.
Right there.
Yeah, I can see.
They are teaming up once again, and they are planning an adaptation of The Night of the Hunter. Now, I believe they're planning to adapt the novel, so
this
strictly...
This is the classic workaround for people who are going to be accused of terrible things on Twitter. We're not remaking the classic film, we're adapting the book.
Yeah, totally different.
But totally different.
You may be aware of this book from the classic film, which was also made from it.
I can't tell Helen whether I love or hate this idea, because...
Oh, yeah, you're... Chris
I'm holding my fist.
Holding his fists up, and where love and hate would be tattooed if he was cool enough to have tattoos.
I will never have tattoos. No, absolutely not. But the great Simpsons joke, of course, is whenever they have their preacher character, he has love, L-U-V. An H hat. Because they only have three fingers.
Because they only have three fingers.
But yes, tell people, Helen, about Night of the Hunter, in case they haven't seen it.
Yeah, so it's basically a killer, a serial killer, actually, who is posing as a preacher and marries a widow who has two young children to get access to her dead husband's hidden loot.
Yes.
And the kids basically cotton on the fact that this dude is no good and are very suspicious of him, and he is basically threatening to kill them. So it was made with Robert Mitchum. Charles Laughton directed it.
Mm-hmm. His only film as director.
His only film as director, and despite being a massive classic, I think it got some sniffy reviews at the time, and he was like, fuck this, I'm off, and didn't make another.
Yeah, show me a film that was made in the 1950s that apparently didn't get sniffy reviews and was badly received at the time.
That has lasted. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a great film, Night of the Hunter. If you haven't seen it, go and seek it out. It is tremendous. Robert Mitchum is terrifying and laconic and menacing, and it's beautifully shot.
Yeah, it's really good.
And it's really, really well directed. And you can see why Scott Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill might be attracted to this as writers. Where this land on their to-do list, I don't know, because I think they're both committed to the Black Phone 2.
Yeah.
So they'll probably do that first and then do this.
But that's proof that they can get really good performances out of kids, which is a big part of this. So that's no bad thing.
All right. I think we're going to wrap up in the movie news section in just 2 secondos, unless you have anything else you want to say. No? I've got one thing I want to say to you guys.
Bring it.
We talked about Colin Farrell's sex tape earlier on, but I've got something Colin Farrell related that's probably much more exciting. The teaser trailer for The Penguin.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah. I watched this. No, it's still...
Because...
It still upsets me that they did that.
The bare minimum.
It still upsets me that they did that, that they hired one of the handsomest men in the world to play that. But this was an interesting... This was an interesting trailer, I thought. This was an interesting hint as to where this series might be going. This is essentially The Penguin talking about how he wants to be respected and maybe even admired as well as feared. And that's kind of an interesting hint to maybe where this character is going to go in the movie, right? Or in the TV show.
Yeah. 8 episode.
All right.
Limited series, I believe. James, traditionally, where do Max shows end up?
Do you know
Sky
what? It's a complete crapshoot. Like, so HBO shows generally arrive on Sky, yes, but Max shows can go anywhere. It may end up on Sky, but then it may not.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm excited about it. It looks great. The fact that Colin Farrell has agreed to do this, do an 8-episode series, perhaps speaks volumes about the material.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to use this to catapult into the Batman Part 2 and use him as one of the big bads in that? Maybe. Mm-hmm. We shall see. I read a story that he apparently had to fight for the Penguin's right not to party, but to smoke a cigar. He was banned from smoking a cigar in the movie.
For PG-13?
I believe so. It's so weird. I mean, I just watched the first Omen and there's smoking all over that.
Yeah. Different time.
Big smoking energy.
But no, I'm excited to see this. It's just, again, it's frustrating. Things like The Walking Dead, Ones Who Live and other streaming shows that do air in the States. Sometimes there's no guarantee when we'll get to see them. Like Peacemaker, right? So that debuted on Max and then it took, what, nearly a year to come over here? So, you know...
Poker Face,
another good example. The Bear, first season of The Bear. You know, it's difficult to say. So this will air, as you say, on Max, but we have yet to find out who in the UK will pick up The Penguin.
Very good. Very good. Last thing I want to talk about is I read this on the BBC, so it must be true, that apparently Stephen Knight, most famously, of course, the co-creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but also the guy behind Peaky Blinders, has said that there will be a Peaky Blinders movie.
Yes.
And it will start
Tommy
filming.
Tommy Shelby will be in it.
Yes. Cillian Murphy, this may be his first post-Oscar thing, coming back to finish off Tommy Shelby's story in Peaky Blinders, the movie, which will start filming apparently in September. My question you, James, is please tell me I don't have to watch Peaky Blinders in order to catch up with this movie.
You 100% do.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
All of it.
I've
come
just
on.
Started watching Friday Night Dinner.
By
I don't have room in my life
Blinders.
For another TV show.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, out Friday Night Dinner then.
Why?
Jesus.
Friday Night Dinner is fantastic.
I mean, it's fine.
It's fine. You're fine.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a nice thing you've ever said to him. Oh, just very quickly before we finish. Love Lies Bleeding star Katie O'Brien has apparently joined Mission Impossible 8.
What?
Yep.
Holy cow.
I mean, it may be in a small role, given that they've been filming for some time now, but
yes.
Still cool that she's getting good work after that.
That's exciting. Well done, Katie O'Brien. All right, time now for our second and final guest this week, and it is a glorious return to the podcast of Luke Evans. He is very, very good in this week's Our Son, in which he co-stars with Billy Porter. Yes, that Billy Porter, as one half of a gay couple who, after many years of marriage, fall out, essentially, and file for divorce. And in the middle is their young son. And it's a custody battle, a kind of gay Kramer versus Kramer, if you will. So since he's been last on the podcast, Luke Evans has been the likes of Disney's Beauty and the Beast, and he's recorded a couple of albums. You know what? I'm going to let him catch you up with his career. But recently he has been pursuing and playing openly gay roles. He's openly gay in real life. And this and the likes of Dan Levy's Good Grief and 9 Perfect Strangers are roles in which he is able to play openly gay characters as well. So we talked about all kinds of stuff in this interview. Always have a good time with Luke Evans. Here we go. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the star of Our Son, Mr. Luke Evans. How are you, sir? You good?
I'm very good. How are you? I'm not too bad. So Luke, you have been on the Empire podcast. I checked this out for 6 years.
What was I on for? What were we talking about last time?
I think it was The Alienist was the last time.
Oh, was that 6 years ago?
Jeez. Yeah, I know. Time, right? It gets away from you.
Yeah, this business has a weird way of messing with your timelines, I find. I think of certain films, I'm like, oh, that was a couple of years ago. And I look online, it's like 10 years ago. I think if you're busy, time blurs, you know, and obviously we don't have a structured 9-to-5 holiday in the summer, Christmas off kind of life. So sometimes it gets very confusing. I lose touch and lose the ability to remember and scheduling when that happened.
But it is a hell of a thing. And you've had a hell of a 6 years since 2018. So what have you been up to and where have you been and encapsulate it all in 35 seconds?
Working, traveling, living, trying to stay healthy, trying to balance work-life mode, which is not easy. And still enjoying what I do, which is a good thing after 6 years. Still excited about working, excited about finding new projects.
Singing.
Yeah, that's since then. Yeah, I've done two albums. Yeah. Launched a brand. What else have I done? Built a house.
Hang on. You built a house by yourself? Okay.
When I say built a house, I mean collectively, somebody else has built it. I designed it.
You chose the designs. You chose the kitchen tops and all that sort of stuff.
Let's just say yes.
Fair enough. And in terms of singing, obviously you get to sing at the end of Our Son as well, which
is
you and Billy Porter.
Well, that was all Billy's doing. I love Billy's voice. And weirdly, our voices are strangely similar, we realized. They blend in quite a beautiful way. Not every voice does, by the way. So this is something we were quite shocked at. And Billy had written this song, and it just sort of felt absolutely perfect for the end credits, Always Be My Man. And also, you know, we were breaking boundaries by doing this. You know, the other love song between two men at the end of a film, you know, that is by the two leading actors in the film who are also gay. So, it was a lovely thing to do. And we recorded it in New York the day after we did the premiere of the film at the Tribeca Film Festival, which was quite a feat.
It's a very good question you posed. If you can find another song of that type in a movie, I think you win a prize, because as far as I can tell, it doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't. And it's a beautiful song. I know Billy and I, we want it to become the gay wedding song of 2024. That's our plan.
People, let us know at the end of the year if you got married to that song.
You can even book us. We'll come and sing. We'll come and sing it for you.
Reasonable prices.
Very expensive.
Only the creme de la creme can afford Luke Evans to Billy Porter. But it's true. You were talking as well about finding projects that kind of make you happy. And that's, I guess, why we all do what we do. But it's been fascinating, you know, this year, Our Son, because of the way it's opened in this country, is following, relatively speaking, hot on the heels of Good Grief, which is this kind of, I don't know, double whammy of Luke Evans relationship dramas that aren't all like as they seem initially. So
yeah, I don't know.
That's just sheer luck, isn't it?
Yes, just luck, just timing, really. It's very odd. Yeah, they've both landed close to each other. Yeah. No, it wasn't the plan, but you know, things happen like that. There's just nothing you can do about it. But they are very different stories. But yeah, relationship dramas. I've done my quota now, I think.
Because there is a third type, of course. There's a Luke Evans relationship drama, in which, not to give too much away, but in which things turn out nicely for everybody. Have you considered maybe one of those?
Well, Our Son does have a silver lining.
It does. It does.
There is hope in that story, which I think is also very real, you know, relationships like that. You know, sometimes, you know, you go through the pain and the heartache and the grieving and the loss and the confusion and the anger. But, you know, with respect and time, you can come out the other side with a different kind of love and a different kind of relationship, which is what Nikki and Gabriel do in Our Son.
Absolutely.
For the sake of their child as well as themselves.
Well, yeah, but getting there is the difficult part. And there are a few scenes between yourself and Billy, which are pretty damn raw. There's a meeting in a divorce attorney's office where things have been under the surface for Nikki for a while, come out about Gabriel's career or lack thereof. And brutal. Those scenes, I mean, there's another scene where you ask him to leave your marital home, and those scenes felt to me incredibly raw, incredibly powerful, and must have been, I don't know, difficult, but also slightly a joy to perform for you?
Oh, they were really difficult. They were very, very painful. I mean, there's a lot of tears shed, and they often weren't, I wasn't thinking that that moment would be emotional, and it was. And when that happens, you know that you really are connected implicitly to the character's journey, when you just emotionally are carried away without any control. And those scenes, you know, it comes down to the writing for sure. You know, those words, when they come out of your mouth in that moment, they transport you somewhere. As an actor, you are not you anymore. You are that person. And it was overwhelming. Very, very often it was overwhelming. There were days when I just couldn't speak or do anything at the end of the day, because it was just so painful. Like, it was, because it's so very real and very relatable. I had empathy for both of those people. And I felt that the story they were going on, sadly, is so common. And people are dealing with divorce and breakups and the pain of, you know, navigating such a difficult thing. And also then having a child involved in that as well adds such a, you know, painful element to it all.
So you immediately sort of connected with the script when it came your way. How did it come your way?
My specification to my team is find things that are challenging, find things that are new, find things that are thought-provoking, conversation starters, and something that I haven't done before. That's it. And sometimes they bring gems like Our Son, and I remember picking it up and I laughed, I cried again, and closed the script in one reading, which is unusual for me, and sat there for like an hour just thinking about it. And I thought, wow, well, you know, that's powerful in itself. Often you finish a story and you're over it and you move on. But this one stayed with me, and I hadn't done it a lot of stories about gay life, but I had read a lot and none of them had resonated with me the way this one did. And so I thought maybe that's the reason why I should do it.
So whenever you're reading a script, ordinarily, do you, even if it's a bad script, do you stick it out to the end, or do you throw it in the trash immediately? Even if it's on an iPad, you just throw it in the trash.
No, I think after reading thousands of scripts at this point, you can tell if a script is good or not. You've got to give it at least 20, 30 pages. And if it really has come cold and you know, nobody's gone, actually just wait until page 68, or trust me, the twist at the end, then I will read it to the end. But usually, you know, I have a vibe, and I think it's a good litmus test anyway. You know, if it hasn't grabbed you within the first 30 pages, there's probably a very good chance it isn't going to grab you, and it's just not for you. Doesn't mean it's not a great script, it just isn't for me, you know.
With Our Son, was there a specific moment, a specific scene that you thought, okay, this is it, I'm in? Unless the next 40 pages is just dross.
No, I think it was after Gabriel had left the house, and it was the first morning when he was with his son, Owen, alone. And he clearly doesn't have the same relationship with his son as Gabriel had. And all of a sudden, you know, he's the only one in the house. He has to get up, find clothes, and put food on the table. And I just loved the realness of that moment between father and son, and him realizing he doesn't know this kid as well as he should. And this kid is complex as well, you know, and has a personality and has an opinion and is fragile and detail and vulnerable. And I just knew that that relationship between me and the young actor Christopher, who played, was going to be really, really enjoyable to play. And it was gorgeous. I loved every second of it. It was very heartwarming to play that, you know. And so yeah, there was that scene and that breakfast scene when he's asked for Pop-Tarts and he's like, "You're not having Pop-Tarts." And he said, Daddy lets me." And I'm like, "Don't worry, if he did, there'd be Pop-Tarts in the cupboard." You know, that kind of dialogue for me was just so real and so relatable and enjoyable. I love the realness of it, the relatableness of it, the universal appeal of it.
So tell me if you can as well, because I'll let you go in a second, about the Good Grief experience, because it's obviously a smaller role, it's a more focused role in terms of you're there for the first, not to give too much away, but you're there for the first 10 minutes of the movie and then you're kind of not. But
yeah, it's just 10 minutes, but the amount of people that stop me on the street or in a restaurant and go, "Wow, I just saw Good Grief." And I'm like, I was only in it for 10 minutes, but it's quite a profound 10 minutes, because the rest of the story is interlaced with that person, and everything that Dan Levy's character finds out and deals with is connected to this person, you know, me. I had quite a clear job specification from Dan when I came into it, you know, that I was going to have to leave my mark within the space of 10 minutes. This character, this energy, this light, this firework had to, you know, leave its mark. So I'm very happy that people even remember me from that 10 minutes, and that I did enjoy being in the film. It's funny, because maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I sent Dan a direct message after I'd seen the final episode of Schitt's Creek, because I was a huge fan of the whole thing. And I admired his writing and I admired everything about it. I thought it was wonderful, the cast, everybody. And I don't know him. And I just thought, you know what? And sometimes I don't do it very often, but if I really think something's great, I'd love to tell that person, you know? So I did, and I did expect a response, and he responded. And he was like, "Thank you so much. It's so lovely that you said that." And I said, no, you deserve everything that you get from this, because it's wonderful. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, he asked me to play his husband in his first directorial debut in a movie that he's written. And I was really touched by that. I also, before I even got the script, knew that it was going to be something really special. And I like Dan. I like him as a person. He's interesting. He's intelligent. He has so much to say and so much to give. And to be part of that film and his first movie was an honor. And obviously Ruth and Hamish playing his best friends, just wonderful. We all went to Soho Farmhouse for a weekend before we did the movie and hung out. And we spent days together just hanging out, chatting, walking, shooting clay pigeons, you know, drinking cocktails and just catching up and being friends and building an awareness of each other that allowed us to present some kind of history on screen, which it absolutely did. He took us to the Crystal Maze one day. Did I tell you that? We went and did Crystal Maze. It was brilliant. I think I got locked in twice. I'm absolutely shit at the fucking Crystal Maze. But anyway, it was very fun.
I've got to let you go, but I have to ask about the Crystal Maze. So what happened to it? Is this the medieval zone, futurist zone, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, it's Crystal Maze. It's on Shaftesbury Avenue. It's where the River Cafe, the Disney's, what's it called? The Rainforest Cafe.
Cafe used to be. Wow.
Yeah, it was great. It was a brilliant thing to do. Dan had really, he wanted us to feel like we had a friendship. We had a relationship, you know. So he put us all together and he took us there. And we actually had the most fun, you know, because we were going, right, who's right for this one? I've only just met Ruth Nigger, but I knew Ruth would be perfect for this one. And surely she was the best out of everybody.
Well, it's unlikely there's going to be a Good Grief 2 for your character in particular, but if there is, I would recommend that Dan takes you all to the Monopoly life-sized on Tottenham Court Road.
Okay, I'm doing that with Dan or without.
It'll blow your mind, Luke. It'll blow your mind. Last thing before I let you go is, what's next for you? And I'm sure you're aware, but they're gearing up for the, what we're told, final part of the Fast and Furious franchise.
Are they?
And frankly, it won't be complete without Owen Shaw.
Well, no, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, I was the first of a legacy of a family that's still in it, still very much front and center as the antagonistic family, the Shaws. And they kept me alive. I don't know why. Maybe there's a reason. Maybe they have a plan. I don't know. But I'd be happy to go back and jump into Owen's shoes one more time, although he is now covered in skin scars because he was in a big fire. So that would be hours in the chair every morning. But anyway, it was very fun to be part of it. And I had a really, really enjoyable time. They were a fun bunch, a lot of them.
Absolutely. And if you come back, you have to have a scene with Helen Mirren, Vanessa Kirby, The Staith, obviously, big family reunion right there.
Well, I did a movie with Helen, and Helen had even forgotten that I was her son because, well, we weren't in the same movie together. I remember sitting at dinner one night. I said, "You do know that I'm your son in another movie." She went, "Are you?" And I went, "Fast and the Furious, dear." She's like, "Oh my God, yes, you are." I was like, "Yes, yes, I'm your son, the bad one. The really bad one."
He's the bad egg of the family. Absolutely. Luke, just take Helen Mirren, Vanessa Kirby, Jason Statham, and yourself to Monopoly life-sized. Make that a life's priority.
That'd be great.
Amazing
Jason
stuff.
Jason would have to win, wouldn't he?
He would have to win. He would have to win, but then he'll probably cheat. But there you go. It is what it is. Luke, it's been an absolute pleasure. Let's not make it 6 years before the next time.
Oh, no, I'm happy to come back.
Cheers, man. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, that was Luke Evans, and Our Son is out now. It is out right now on digital format, should you wish to see it. I don't think you guys have seen it.
Not yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
It's really good. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, perhaps a little low-key, perhaps a little muted at times, but I also felt it was really, really compelling and at times quite moving as well. It's directed by Bill Oliver, and the performances are great. Luke Evans, wonderful at the heart of this. And Billy Porter, if you only know Billy Porter as this fabulous, flamboyant creation off screen, is much more tampered down in this. And they're both fantastic. And there's some really, really affecting and moving emotional scenes. I don't know if we have an official Empire review for this. I'd be in the high 3, low 4 camp. It's well worth a watch. Our Son, out right now in all digital formats. And out right now in all cinematic formats is Kung Fu Panda 4, Hell's Bells.
Yeah.
Poe is back.
Poe is back, back, back.
Has he brought Tinky Winky, Dipsy and Lala with him?
Honestly, he's the best thing about this. He's the thing that I enjoyed most about this film. He is, of course, again, voiced by Jack Black. This one's directed by Mike Mitchell.
Oh,
yep.
You like him.
We do. So basically this time Poe is under some pressure from Master Shifu
Master Chef.
The Master Chief. Shifu.
Master Shifu. No. That's John 117 character. He's been around for a while, guys.
Oh, didn't he die in the first one?
Isn't that the other one? No, he's Master Shifu is the wise red panda.
Right, because the tortoise is definitely dead.
The tortoise is dead.
Who's the character who then kind of burst into butterflies in the first one? I'll be honest, I've only seen the first one. I really liked the first one, but I felt no need to catch up with the rest.
Did it leave you po-faced?
Hey,
it didn't actually. I thought it was quite funny and at times really, really quite beautiful, including the scene where the character, I can't remember,
bursts into butterflies
because he dies.
Bursts into butterflies.
He bursts in butterflies or blossom.
Or blood. Or dies blood. In the hail of bullets.
It's Grandmaster Oogway.
Okay, voiced by?
Randall Duk Kim.
And who voices the Master Chief?
That's Halo, isn't it?
That's Pablo Schreiber.
Ah.
Okay.
Anyway, So, Kung Fu Panda 4. So, Po has been the dragon warrior now for a while. The Furious Five are all off having other adventures, so they don't need to pay Angelina Jolie or Jackie Chan to be in this movie.
The Furious Five, that's what they're called.
Aren't they the Furious Five?
I know, you may well be right. I have no idea, but I just think...
I may be misremembering.
Is that a deliberate Fast Five reference? I'm just curious.
So, he's basically under pressure to choose a new candidate, and he doesn't really want any of them, and he decides... that really he should keep being the dragon warrior. Meanwhile, a fox bandit voiced by Awkwafina.
No.
Yeah. Turns up to try and steal a bunch of stuff from the monastery, and he imprisons her. But then he learns that Tai Lung, the bad guy voiced by Ian McShane in the very first film, appears to have come back. And when he investigates, he learns that no, it's not actually Ian McShane. It's a chameleon voiced by Viola Davis, who's also a sorcerer. I mean, Viola Davis, not the character, who is trying to take over the world, essentially.
Right.
So he has to fight a chameleon who can become any of his old bad guys.
But chooses to become Viola Davis.
No, she is Viola Davis, but she chooses to become Ian McShane.
Cool.
I get it. Viola Davis pretending to be Ian McShane is coming for Jack Black. No, I've got it.
Does she say cocksucker at any point?
She doesn't with her words, but very
it's
much
implied.
With her attitude. Yeah, it's a journey for Po and Jen, who is the fox, who's Awkwafina's fox. I feel like we've seen her play this character before, but that's okay. And then they're actually followed in the end by Mr. Ping, who's the goose who adopted Po at the beginning, and then his actual real father, Lee Shan, who's the Bryan Cranston character. And they have their own little adventure here, which is very charming as well. I mean, I'll be honest, I really liked the character of Po, and I really like Jack Black's performance as the character. I think he's great. I like Awkwafina in pretty much everything, even though I feel like I've seen her do this before. I feel like she's done a lot of animation work, right? Like, I just have that energy. But as a film, like, I struggle to remember anything about any of the Kung Fu Panda movies. Yeah. I remember a little bit about the first one, the setup of that. I remember there was a bad peacock, possibly voiced by Gary Oldman in the second one. Could not have told you before going into this what, if anything, happened in the third. But I guess that was where he found his
There's a bull.
Panda dad.
Is that the bull? There's definitely a bull in
there
one
There is
of
a
them.
General bull who turns up here, so I guess he must have been the third guy, bad guy, maybe. And I think that's where he went and found his panda dad. Anyway, like, it's all very charming, and it's beautifully animated, as you said. It's the design of these is really, really lovely, but they're not perhaps the most memorable films.
No.
I will say that Viola Davis makes a pretty effective baddie. Like, if you're going to have a baddie, like, Viola Davis is a solid bad guy.
I've always said she's a chameleon.
Yeah, she really is, isn't she?
Mm. Mm.
3 stars then for Kung Fu Panda 4, which is very, very exciting. Kicking ass and taking names at the box office.
He literally says that about kicking ass and taking
names. At the box office.
But he's not even sure about the names bit, he says.
And then Viola Davis goes, cocksucker.
Again, not with her words, but her attitude.
Her looks and her stance.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Exciting. Exciting stuff indeed. Next up, let's talk about Drift. Jimbo.
Yes, indeed. So this is Anthony Chen's film. This is his first English language film, in fact. And this is based on the novel by Alexander Maksik called A Marker to Measure Drift, which is a far less catchy title. And this stars Cynthia Erivo as Jacqueline, as we've said. And she is, yes, she is kind of a Liberian refugee, but it's slightly more complex than that. So she's been living in London with her girlfriend and her girlfriend's family. And she goes back home to Liberia to see her family for a while. And they seem like quite a well-to-do family. We see a lot of this through flashbacks. It's kind of, they're very short and economical, these flashbacks. They give you little glimpses of her life in Liberia. And something terrible happens to her and to her family in Liberia. And we gradually see that eked out through flashbacks as the film continues. And somehow she's managed to get to a Greek island, and she's eking out an existence on this Greek island. So she's sleeping on the beach in a cove, like getting money or scrounging food wherever she can. And she's clearly suffering from very, very acute PTSD. She's obviously been through an awful lot, and she's struggling. She's struggling just to stay alive, and it's actually quite heartbreaking. Just little things that you don't think of, like she's, you know, she has nowhere to go. She has one set of clothes. She watches it in the sea every night and hangs it up, and then puts it on again in the morning. But there's, you know, moments of how does she get food? How does she get money? But then when she gets her period at one point, it's like, how does she deal with that without access to basic sanitary products? Like, it's all very traumatic for her, heaped on the trauma that she's already experienced. And I guess the light from this film comes from the fact that she is sitting in a sort of a ruin, and Alia Shawkat, she's a tour guide, she turns up with her group and she's showing them around, and the two of them get talking and they strike up a kind of a quiet friendship, and Callie seeks Jacqueline out whenever she can, and they have a few moments where I think Jacqueline sort of pretends that she's on holiday, she's staying in a villa with her husband. You get the sense that Callie doesn't entirely buy it, but she takes it at her word and she sort of quietly sits with her. And the two of them just share a lot of silences together, just sitting with each other very companionably. And bit by bit, you see that Callie's kind of reaching out to her, trying to help her. There's not a lot more to the plot than that. It's quite a small film in terms of the scope of its storyline. It's really just a character study. It's a look at these two women, specifically Jacqueline, and looking at her, how she is trying to hold the pieces of her personality together after suffering this unimaginable trauma. And obviously, you've heard the interview already, if you, in fact, listened to that interview. And that's about a very particular flashback scene that is, I think it's fair to say, should have all the trigger warnings. Like, it's incredibly harrowing. It's the only part of this film that is very difficult to watch, but it is absolutely brutal. And Cynthia Erivo's performance in that is absolutely smash it out of the park incredible. Like, it's heartbreaking, it's devastating, both in the actual flashback itself and as she recounts the story while sitting in the bath.
That's the scene we talked about. Yeah. The recounting of the flashback.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it is a lot to get through, but it's just, it's so beautifully done. And also, props to Alia Shawkat. Like, she is entirely relegated to response expression. She sits very quietly and just cries as she hears the, again, it's a wonderful performance. So, you know, is it a big plot film? No, but I think as a you know, a tour de force for acting, it's incredible. And as a character study, it's very, very interesting. It's only an hour and a half. It's not long, but it's well worth catching if you can.
Yeah, I thought this was terrific. It's so gentle and it lures you in to Jacqueline's world and this little ritual that she goes through every day to stay alive, to stay sane. This is set in the few years ago, I think it's set in the mid-90s. So that explains why she can't just call people on their mobiles and things like that and arrest her situation. It's really great. And then it goes up a notch in terms of its emotional impact towards the end. I saw some quite snippy reviews of this and I don't really see where they're coming from. I think that this is a movie that stays with you, haunts you a little bit. The performances are second to none. And Cynthia Erivo in this is so incredible. This, you know, it's maybe a performance that sticks around a little bit when it comes to awards season. Maybe. I don't know. Maybe, of course, it's a character played by Alia Shawkat in Arrested Development, but I don't know when this came out in the States. I probably should
last
know that.
It was last year.
Yeah. All right, so it's already escaped the awards conversation, but, you know, a BAFTA nomination ain't out the question.
She's only one letter away from an EGOT. She's going to have to wait a little bit longer, I guess. Yeah.
She's got the Empire Award. She's got the E, she's got the G, she's got the T, but she ain't got the O. She needs to get the O. Give her the O, you motherfuckers. Honestly. Cowards. Four stars then for Drift. I'm gonna review Godzilla X Empire, the new Kong, or whatever it's called, in just a second. But Hell's Bells, before that we have Mother's Instinct. Right, this is Anne Hathaway, Jessica Chastain. Boom, I'm calling it already. This is the new The 355. This is The 355 times two.
The 356?
The 356.
This is, I want to be clear, it's a lot better than
this
that.
This is the 710, is what I'm saying.
Wow, yeah, it's more like the 710. So this is set in the... Jeez. This is set in the 60s, and Anne Hathaway plays Celine. Jessica Chastain plays Alice. They live next door. They have sons the same age. They have, you know... 1960s all-American husbands who go off to work every morning in their big cars and they pack a lunch and they wave them off and greet them at the door when they come back with a cocktail. They live these picture-perfect lives. And then there's a tragic accident that changes Celine's life forever. Oh my God. And it changes the dynamic between them. And it introduces a lot of grief, a lot of guilt, a lot of paranoia, a lot of mutual suspicion as time goes on. And it's really watching how that plays out. This is kind of Hitchcockian, and not just because Jessica Chastain has perfect blonde hair. They are both, by the way, perfectly dressed in every scene. This is directed by Benoît Delhomme, who is his background as a cinematographer. He actually stepped in to make this after the director of the original, I think, Belgian film that it's based on dropped out for, I don't know, scheduling reasons or creative differences or something, and he stepped in to make this his debut as a director.
Okay.
Yeah. But that might be why it looks as gorgeous as it does. But seriously, also incredible costumes, incredible design, everything else. But the point is that underneath these picture-perfect lives, you know, you've got Alice feeling incredibly frustrated and constrained by this stultifying middle-class, you know, suburban life. You have a history of some, you know, mental health problems, certainly in her past. When the tragedy happens, Celine also has mental health problems. So there are issues of, can either of them necessarily trust their perceptions of everything that's going on? So there, it gets in some kind of thorny areas. And then it also has a really kind of, I don't know if crowd-pleasing is the right word, but a really satisfying psychological thriller kind of an element going on here. Like, it's a proper grown-up film for grown-ups, but like a proper old thriller.
Mm-hmm.
I really think Hitchcock would quite enjoy this. I'm not saying it's like necessarily Hitchcock levels of genius, but I do think it's proper, sophisticated, grown-up, and really quite clever in the way that it looks at the dynamics between these two women. Yeah, I had a great time. Really enjoyed it.
So do we.
Yeah.
As a magazine, I haven't seen this yet. I'm hoping to see it. No, I'm not going to. I've just checked the clock. I am not making tonight's screening of 10 past 6 in Greenwich. Nope, that's not going to happen. That ship has sailed, sadly. But four stars then for Mother's Instinct. And that leads us inexorably to Godzilla X Kong.
Dawn of Justice.
Colon, the new Empire.
Frozen Empire.
I am a big fan of Hollywood suddenly deciding to incorporate the name of our magazine / podcast / just world-beating brand into their movies. They know that at this time of box office struggle, they need a little extra something to get them over the edge, you know, to that little kick, that little sort of nitrous kick
mm-hmm.
that Dom Treader loves so much. We are that kick. We are the kick for the Ghostbusters. You say that you may scoff, Helen, but Ghostbusters Frozen Empire opened to $1 million more at the box office than Ghostbusters Afterlife did. So
Wow. That's
the Empire effect.
That's the Empire effect.
That sure is. It sure is the Empire effect. Or if these two movies underperform, then you will never hear the word Empire. We'll just be called the Film Podcast at that point. So this is Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire. Can't believe it's opening a week after the old one. It's like the first Omen opening 2 weeks after the Immaculate. I mean, who's scheduling these things? Anyway, only I have seen this at time of recording. Mm. Helen and James are Godzilla bound.
Literally about to go.
Which is very, very exciting for them. I will say we've given this 3 stars as a magazine. We may review it in greater depth and detail on next week's show. Once these two guys have seen it, because it's a fun film to talk about. Basically, your opinion of this movie will depend entirely on your opinion of the last movie, which was also directed by Adam Wingard. That, of course, was Godzilla versus Kong. If you thought that movie was a fun, technicolor, self-aware, tiny, little bit dumb blockbuster in the classic Fast and Furious style, only with a giant ape and a giant lizard that can breathe atomic fire, punching each other whilst human characters who don't really make much of an impact stand around and look at it and going, that's pretty impressive, don't you think? If you thought that movie was a load of fun, which I did, then you're going to think that this movie is likewise a load of fun because it's by and large
the same movie.
The same movie. it is and it isn't. There's little tweaks and twists, and Adam Wingard tries different things with this. You know, this is obviously promising a big Godzilla and Kong team up. They were enemies last time, but this time, is there
enemies
a threat?
To lovers?
Enemies to lovers? Frenemies. Keep your frenemies close and your frenemies closer, or whatever it is. And this is just glorious nonsense for me. It is very, very aware of its own preposterousness. It has a new character in the shape of Dan Stevens, who gets an all-timer of a character intro, by the way. And it's, of course, his reunion with Adam Wingard after The Guest. And he's a lot of fun in this movie, although, you know, this is a movie about Kong, the giant ape, and Godzilla, the giant whatever the fuck Godzilla is. And it's perhaps less interested in the humans, who are also played in this movie by Rebecca Hall and Brian Tyree Henry and Kaylee Hottle from the first film as Gia, the young hearing impaired girl who has a spiritual connection with Kong. And they're all back. Can you remember what Rebecca Hall's character is called?
No, of course not.
Of course not. Is that the point?
No.
Yeah, it's fine.
Is she wildly overqualified for her role here?
Yes. Yes, as is Brian Tyree Henry.
As is Brian Tyree Henry.
But they're a lot of fun. But you come for these movies to see giant monsters smashing the shit out of each other. And brothers and sisters, boy, do I have good news for you, because you are going to get a lot of that in this film. Now, if you are not of that opinion about Godzilla versus Kong, then you may think this is one of the worst movies ever made, and you may think that this is in many ways anti-cinema, and you may be outside picketing it. That's entirely up to you, of course. In terms of quality level, this is not on the Godzilla minus one step, but it is a ton of fun. I had a blast. Turn on, tune in, and drop out. That's what I say. 3 stars for Godzilla X Kong, the New Empire. There you go. I think on that note, that is pretty much it. There's just one last thing I wanted to say. Did you guys see this?
What's that?
Did you guys see this? This incredible news story that I just saw perhaps you can guess, a very famous movie prop has just sold at auction for $718,750. Can you tell me what that very famous movie prop is?
Is it?
I can.
The 15-inch black rubber cock from Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
Oh, jeez.
It is not.
It is not. I know what it is, though.
Helen knows what it is.
Yeah. It's the door from Titanic.
Yes, I actually
did know
that.
The thing that they float on.
Mm. Which you can absolutely fit 2 people on.
Yeah. Not so much a prop as a murder weapon.
Wow.
Yeah. All she had to do was scooch up.
Rose used that door to murder Jack, and she should feel the full force of the law.
Never forget, never
forget.
She fucking
throws away the evidence linked there. She's not tossing the heart of the stone into the ocean at the end as a gesture for Jack, her lost lover. She's doing it to get rid of fucking evidence.
It's fine. You know why? Because Britney Spears' astronaut boyfriend went down there and got it for her.
Ah, oh, dear. Anyway, on that note, that is definitely it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by... It's a full house next week. It's a full house.
God,
yeah, really? I've done it again. So Scoop is out.
Like Britney Spears. Oops, I did it again.
Oops, I did it again. Yes, I thought you'd full house. That's a strange Britney song. I don't know that one. Yes, Scoop is out, which is the tale of the interview on Newsnight between Emily Maitlis and Prince Andrew of the royal family fame.
Thanks for clarifying.
And we're joined by the star of that film, Rufus Sewell, who plays Prince Andrew, and the film's director, Philip Martin.
Cool.
Yeah. But we're also joined by the stars of the first Omen, Dominoes,
Didymus,
Nell Tigerfree, and Bill Nighy.
Ooh. Yeah.
And just for good measure, we're joined by the producer of Dev Patel's sensational debut as a director, Monkey Man, Mr. Jordan Peele. Oh, yes, indeed. That's a hell of a lineup.
That's a hell of a lineup.
We might not even bother turning up. Just press play on all 3 of those interviews, and that's a good time at the movies. Anyway, until we meet again, until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my 2 colleagues of such lethal cunning, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, James. I was expecting more, quite frankly.
You get nothing more from me at this time in the afternoon. I'm done.
Are you not? Have you stopped doing Pilot? Is this what you? Well, is this your Easter gift to me?
Yes,
you
that's
have stopped?
It. Pilot is no more. No, that's not true. In fact, we're doing 2 pilots this week because we have a spoiler special for 3 Body Problem, which also goes out on Pilot this week. In fact, we'll probably go out the same day this very podcast goes out.
Whoa!
With all 3 of the showrunners speaking to none other than Hyper Nerd Helen O'Hara.
It's me.
Wow. There we go. That's exciting. I'm glad I asked now. It's goodbye from our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. I've got to go and eat some eggs.
Toodaloo. And it's goodbye for me. If I really run, you guys can make it to Godzilla, X Kong, the New Empire. And if I really run, I might make it to that screening of Mother's Instinct, the New Empire, after all. Just maybe.
Run, Chris, run.
I believe in myself. Unfortunately, my knees stopped believing in me a long time ago.
Also, it's Good Friday, so be excellent to each other.
Yes, enjoy, Oi. Everybody. Enjoy. Do not get into any cars in which Pierce Brosnan is in the passenger seat.
I was about
That's
to say the same thing.
Good advice on a long Good Friday, I would say. Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Have a good Easter, everybody. Enjoy yourselves, and thanks in advance for the chocolate. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.